Welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. In a few minutes, for the principal segment of our show, Dennis Mihalik will be speaking with Earl Labor about Jack London. But first, let's look back at this week in history, June 29th through July 5th. On June 30th, 1971, the 26th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, lowering the minimum voting age to 18. On July 1st, 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg began. On July 2nd, 1776, the American Continental Congress passed a resolution that, quote, these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. 2 days later, on July 4th, the same Continental Congress approved the Declaration of Independence, which explained the resolution of July 2nd. And on July 5th, 1946, the bikini bathing suit made its debut at a fashion show in Paris. Turning to this week's History in the News segment, a replica of the Amistad, made famous by the movie of the same title, is being constructed. A nonprofit educational association, Amistad America, and the Maritime Museum, Mystic Seaport, have joined forces to construct the replica by the year 2000. The schooner will eventually tour various ports as a floating educational facility, becoming a vehicle for exploring the meaning of slavery in the United States. Nine of Albert Einstein's recently discovered letters suggest that he had a romance during World War II with a Soviet spy. Her name was Margarita Kononkova, and according to the recently published memoirs of Soviet spy master Pavel Sudoplatov, her task was to influence prominent American scientists like Einstein to speak favorably about the Soviet Union. Such propaganda, it seems, was worth even more to the Soviets at the time than any scientific information Einstein may have given them. There is no evidence, however, that Einstein knew of Kononkova's spy activities. And finally, at least one Southerner continues to fight his own little civil war. More than a century after General Sherman's troops burned every building on the property, Henry Ingram, in Hardeeville, South Carolina, has filed a deed in the local county courthouse with restrictions barring the sale of his land to anyone north of the Mason-Dixon line and anyone named Sherman. At the time of its burning in 1865, the land was occupied by one of the largest rice plantations in the area. Ingram purchased it earlier this year and intends to put a motel, convenience store, and restaurant there, along with homes for himself and his family. Open to question, of course, is whether federal law prevents discrimination against Northerners in such transactions. You're listening to Talking History. Call of the Wild remains one of the classic adventure books in American literature, and its author, Jack London, one of the nation's best-known writers. This year marks the centennial of an adventure in London's life that led to his writing of that novel. To discuss that adventure with our special guest for this show, Earl Labor, is my colleague, Dennis Mihalik. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. 100 years ago, the American literary giant Jack London spent the winter of 1897-98 in the Yukon, attempting to cash in on the gold rush. While he found no precious metals, most scholars believe he mined the experiences of that winter to produce his best works, including the novel The Call of the Wild. To help us understand the person and his literary contribution is our guest today, Dr. Earl Labor, who received his Ph.D. at the University of Wisconsin in 1960 and currently is Wilson Professor of American Literature at Centenary College in Shreveport, Louisiana. As a Fulbright Scholar in 1974 at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, he presented the first Jack London course in Western Europe. Having already published about 50 articles and 8 books about the works of Jack London, he is currently under contract with Farrar, Straus, and Giraud to publish what purportedly will be the definitive biography of Jack London. Welcome, Dr. Labor.
Thank you.
In establishing a context for Jack London, I understand that actually he grew up in poverty and lived a fairly unconventional childhood. Could you give us a brief description of his formative years?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement about his childhood. Born out of wedlock, his mother married John London when Jack was about 9 months old. They moved frequently when he was a youngster in and out of the city, I think possibly because of the financial circumstances of the family, and also because Flora London, Jack's mother, was very ambitious and kept pushing John London to do better than he was doing. He was a pretty good farmer, but she wouldn't let him stay in one place long enough to really get rooted and make the kind of living that the family needed. Finally, when Jack was about 9, they moved back into Oakland from the ranch they had lived on there, and Jack, writing to his first publisher, said that from my ninth year on, my life was nothing but toil, especially manual labor is what he was talking about. And he threw newspapers, had two newspaper routes at one time, and when he graduated from grammar school, he went to work immediately in a factory, sometimes working 16, 18 hours a day at 10 cents an hour in the factory. Got tired of that fairly young, and started a series of escapades that culminated in his being a member of the gang on the Oakland waterfront that called themselves the Oyster Pirates. In fact, he was named the Prince of the Oyster Pirates. That was when he was only 15 years old.
Royalty at 15.
Exactly. And he was running with a bunch of grown men. I mean, we're not talking about the ordinary juvenile delinquent. So he was a man amongst the men at a very early age.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, how does this unschooled youth transform himself into a professional journalist and novelist?
A couple of factors, I think. He bought into the American dream. He'd always been an omnivorous reader, even from early childhood, and had read the Horatio Alger novels and books of that sort. And then, when he came back from his first ocean voyage, he was an able-bodied sailor on a ship that had gone out to hunt seals in the Northwest Pacific. He entered a contest for young writers and won $25, which was the equivalent of a month's pay in the factory back in those days. So he thought, well, maybe I can do a lot better writing than I can do working in a factory. But, of course, he was competing against amateurs then and didn't do any good at all at first when he was trying to become a professional writer. Had to go back to factory work and what have you, and then hit the road with Kelly's Army, the Western contingent of Cox's Army, in 1894 it was, wound up spending a month in the Erie County Penitentiary, was arrested for vagrancy. And he said later on, he says, I saw things there that I could scarcely think about, much less write about. But he determined he was never again going to be put in that situation, went back to the West Coast and entered Oakland High School. And that's when he began to get some real education there, and spent a semester also in the University of California. So this was the beginning of his writing career.
Mm-hmm. And then it's at about that time that he decided to take off and seek his fortune in the Yukon?
Right. 1897, they first got the word of the big gold strike in the Klondike, and he and his brother-in-law took off and went on up there really a year ahead of the big gold rush. And he spent almost a full year in the Klondike before he had to leave and come back home because of scurvy.
So it wasn't a very successful adventure for him.
Well, in terms of the money, no. I think he brought back about $4.50 in gold dust, but he brought back millions in terms of what he had soaked up and converted into his writing from that experience. He said later on, he says, it was in the Klondike I found myself. There you get your perspective. I got mine. And sure enough, he did.
He did. And then this is, that insight is what he turned into a number of successful works, especially The Call of the Wild?
Yes. And he got his start when he came back in the fall of 1898 and broke into print first in the Overland Monthly and then about 6 months later in the Atlantic Monthly, which was the premier magazine in the country, perhaps in the world at the time. And then within a year, he was hailed as the Kipling of the Klondike. And a couple of years after that, in 1902, he wrote The Call of the Wild, which came out the following year and was an overnight classic.
Mm-hmm.
It was instantly acclaimed as a great work.
Why do you think it got such immediate popularity and acclaim?
Well, it appeals to something I think that's been all of us left out, a desire to be free for a kind of spiritual self-fulfillment or what have you. It's not really a dog story at heart. It's a story about the human spirit, I think, and that has been a book that has caught on worldwide. I call it America's greatest world novel. It's been translated into about 86 different foreign languages.
Mm-hmm. For those who may not have read it, in a few points, could you outline the theme of Call of the Wild?
Well, the theme, I think, is epitomized in the title. You have this great dog named Buck who is kidnapped and taken to the Northland and bit by bit discovers what it's like to be free and roaming and ultimately winds up as the great ghost dog of the Northland leaping over the Aurora Borealis. As I say, it's really more a poem than it is a novel. I think it was the critic Maxwell Geismar said it's a beautiful prose poem of gold, death on the instinctual level, a handsome parable of the buried impulses, and that applies, I think, to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it touched something in the American psyche of that era?
Especially then. Remember, that was the same era of Theodore Roosevelt and his strenuous call to life or what have you. We had become a highly industrialized country just in the generation before that, and I think at that point we're ready to break out, get back to nature or what have you. So there was a terrific appeal for books that dealt with the wilderness. You know, the national park system and all that was being established at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of its style, I mean, I'm fascinated by a person who goes to grammar school and then can win a writing prize, who really didn't graduate from college and then writes this quintessential novel and is a very successful professional journalist. How would you describe his style and how did he acquire it?
Well, first off, he's a genius.
I mean, that usually helps, yes.
He was an incredible genius, and a lot of that talent came naturally. Evidently, even as a child, he was pretty good at telling stories. But he worked very hard, too. When he really got into the business of trying to compete professionally, he spent sometimes 12, 14 hours a day at the typewriter. He copied out whole sections from Kipling and from Stevenson and other writers that he thought were very successful.
Mm-hmm.
He also was a fan of Herman Melville, so I think he was picking up maybe even instinctively some of their styles.
Mm-hmm. Now, Herman Melville and Moby Dick, you've mentioned Rudyard Kipling a couple of times. Were there comparisons made to Kipling and his stories in India and London and his Yukon stories?
Yes, there were. Not to Melville, because Melville wasn't a big thing in the canon at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Jack was one of the first, I think, to fully appreciate him among the professional writers. But certainly Kipling was world known and very popular at the time, as was Stevenson.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in terms of his other Yukon work, is there a pattern to it that they're all similar to The Call of the Wild, or are there distinctive features?
No, there are a number of different features, I think. You get a very different kind of novel, in a sense, with White Fang. He just reverses the process there and sends this wild wolf dog back to civilization. But you get a lot of the stories that deal with human ethics and what have you. His first novel deals with a kind of liberated woman called the Daughter of the Snows, very much in advance of her time, as a matter of fact. So there are a number of different themes. Of course, you've got greed, the business of gold hunting. You've got heroism in terms of man pitted against nature, perhaps the most famous example of that being his classic story, To Build a Fire.
Yes. Now, after the flurry of the Yukon-related work, could you briefly give us a capsule of the remainder of his unfortunate short career?
Well, I'd call it a fortunate short career. Some of the highlights, he was a correspondent at the Russo-Japanese War for the Hearst Corporation. I think the only foreign correspondent that managed to get through to the front. And the Japanese shipped him back away from the front as soon as they found out he was up there. But that was a major point. Also, his cruise of the Snark, I think, is a highlight. He helped design his own boat to sail around the world and spent a couple of years sailing that boat through the Pacific and what have you before having to return home from a number of tropical ailments he picked up, at which point he started developing what is now the Jack London State Historical Park. It's a 1,500-acre ranch that he called Beauty Ranch. He wanted to be a model ranch in which he restored the worn-out hillsides to their full fertility and to breed prized livestock and what have you. A couple hundred acres of that is still in the hands of the estate and are the Jack London Vineyards, by the way. His perhaps most important novel after Klondike was the novel Martin Eden, which is a very powerful indictment of the American dream, also strongly autobiographical. Then perhaps the major highlight of his late career is his discovery of the works of Carl Gustav Jung about 6 months before he died. And he says, I came running to his wife, says, I'm standing on the edge of the world so new and wonderful and terrible, I'm almost afraid to look over into it.
Mm-hmm.
But he did look over into it and wrote a half dozen stories deliberately incorporating Jungian theory into that fiction. As far as I know, he's the first writer ever to do that.
Mm-hmm. In the minute that we have left, what is Jack London's current status in the American literary canon?
I'd say it's rising. We have the Jack London Society now. In fact, that society will be sponsoring an international Jack London symposium out at the Huntington Library in October. Be scholars from all over the world coming to that, including the officers of the Jack London Society of Japan and folks from Europe as well as other parts of Asia. So I'd say he's gaining status here. He's had it abroad all along, but it's only been recently that we've really got him into the canon in the United States.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Labor. We've been talking to Dr. Earl Labor, who has explained the status of the American literary giant Jack London, who, again, 100 years after his Yukon adventure, seems to be ascending in the American literary circles.
In place of our site of the week, rather than send you to the Yukon, we've decided to recommend some summer reading for you. Until Earl Labor's book is released, you might try Jack London, A Life, written by Alex Kershaw and recently published by St. Martin's Press. As you heard in our interview today, London crammed a lot of activity into his brief 40 years on this earth. He lived adventure and he wrote it, making both his life and work fascinating to his many biographers and readers. Kershaw's book is a good introduction to that life and work. Once again, the title of the book is Jack London, A Life by Alex Kershaw. For this week's radio op-ed piece, in keeping with the subject of our show, we've asked Brent Spencer to offer his observation on Jack London. Spencer is the director of creative writing at Creighton University. He's also the author of the novel The Lost Son and a collection of short stories, Are We Not Men?, chosen by the Village Voice as one of the best books of 1996.
Jack London was the first person in the history of the human race who ever actually wrote a book. Until him, books just came to life by spontaneous generation, like fruit flies. At least that's what I thought when I was young and dumb. Don't get me wrong, I loved books. I ate up whole library shelves, but I was as ignorant of where books come from as I was about where babies come from. Then one day I stumbled on a book by Jack London, a book whose authorship could not be denied. Here was a writer. Here was a man whose life leaped off the page. He wrote about everything from boxing to the Molokai lepers. But the book he wrote that changed my life was Call of the Wild. Emily Dickinson said she knew when she'd read a good poem because it felt as though the top of her head had been taken off. Well, that's what happened to me when I read Call of the Wild. My whole head blew off, rolled across the floor, bounced down the stairs, out the front door, and into the yard to stop in wide-eyed wonderment at a world I never knew existed. Call of the Wild. The title itself is a call to adventure, words to make the heart drum and the blood thrum. How else to explain the fascination with the phrase? We've got the Call of the Wild RV park, and even the Call of the Wild Executive Adventure Team Building Training Program. Everyone wants to respond to that call. But the Call of the Wild that mattered to me was the story of Buck, the dog who goes from the sun-kissed Santa Clara Valley to the frigid Klondike, meeting every challenge with quiet dignity. I love this book, so wise in the ways of dogs and men. If you've read it, you remember the scene, how could you forget it, where Buck's owner, John Thornton, rashly bets that Buck can break out a sled weighed down with 1,000 pounds of flour and pull it 100 yards. Thornton and his friends bet everything they have on Buck when no one else has faith in him. And then Buck does the impossible, pulling the heavy sled across the hard pack. I wanted a dog like that. Hell, I wanted to be a dog like that. London writes, from far away drifted a faint, sharp yelp, followed by a chorus of similar sharp yelps. As the moments passed, the yelps grew closer and louder. Again, Buck knew them as things heard in that other world which persisted in his memory. He walked to the center of the open space and listened. It was the call, the many-noted call, sounding more luringly and compellingly than ever before. And, as never before, he was ready to obey. How can you resist that call, the call of the wild? It's also what Robert Coles has described as the call of stories. It's the reason reading matters so much, the call of the world outside ourselves. And it's the reason I turned out like the writer David Foster Wallace, who says, I'm the kind of guy who jumps into a cab and says, the library, and step on it. So here's to you, Jack London, my father, my brother, my pal.
You've been listening to Brent Spencer, author of the novel The Lost Son, and a collection of short stories, Are We Not Men? And finally, our list of coming attractions, upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of an historical nature that may be of interest to our listeners. This week, we call to your attention a photographic exhibition open until September 6th at the International Center of Photography in New York City. The exhibit is called Matthew Brady's Portraits, Images as History, Photography as Art. Most audiences know Brady for his images of the Civil War, but those photographs constituted only a small fraction of Brady's life work. This exhibit, which was organized by the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, focuses on Brady's portraits, the larger portion of his work. It includes over 130 photographs, paintings, prints, and even cameras, providing not only information on Brady's work, but on the relationship between his portraiture and 19th century American culture. Contact the International Center of Photography for more specific information. And that's about it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.
Show me a place where I don't have to worry.